Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up later on today's show, we hear a regional poet react to COVID-19. But we are going to start with our tradition the day after Thanksgiving to follow in the footsteps of StoryCorps and provide a retail-free alternative to Black Friday and celebrate a day of listening. The act of listening, deep listening, really putting yourself aside and listening to what somebody or something has to say is one of the greatest gifts that we can give. Dr. Eric Anderson is a professor of music at Minot State University, and he is the co-director of the Minot State University String Ensemble. He picked up his first cello at the tender age of 3 and had classical training and grew up listening to classical music. But of course, like many a red-blooded American male, he went through a phase of liking a lot of rock music, which he still does. And in fact, he often combines his love of both. He also loves baseball, and he gives a lecture on baseball and symphonic music, specifically the works of the composer Brahms, and how your experience will change depending on your level of knowledge. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Ashley. Happy to be here.
Where did the idea to put baseball and classical music in one lecture come from?
Back when I was doing my doctoral degree at the Cincinnati Conservatory, my graduate professor in cello was Yehuda Hanani, and I was serving as his teaching assistant. One of my duties was to drive him back and forth from the airport. He flew in from New York on Mondays and then flew out on Tuesdays and taught all his lessons in that short time. This gave us a lot of time to talk, and whereas he and I loved to talk music and what lay below the surface in music, I think it came up one day. It must have been around October, and I was talking about the World Series or the playoffs, and it came out that he really didn't understand baseball or understand why anyone would like baseball. And it occurred to me that one of the reasons I love baseball so much is because it has that same sort of below the surface complexity that draws me to music. Knowing that he already spoke that one language, many of our conversations had to do with trying to demystify the sport of baseball and sort of add another layer of understanding to the way he might interface with that.
What do they have in common to someone who is an aficionado of both?
Well, I think it has to do with the way that we experience the world. And our senses take in information, and in many cases, in things that we're familiar with, we interpret those to provide a whole, you know, multi-leveled understanding. We project meaning onto things that wouldn't ostensibly have any meaning to them. So the way baseball and the symphonic music of Brahms, the way I was thinking about these is, many people sit there and watch baseball. Many people sit in a concert hall and listen to a symphony, and all of those people receive pretty much an identical set of sensory data. They all experience the same thing. But based on the level of engagement with the material, experience with the material, in terms of what you know and how much you're engaging with it, the experience of every individual is quite different. And for many people, like with baseball, in fact, I would say I follow baseball better on TV. When I'm at the ballpark, and I'm a Seattle Mariners fan. I even actually put on my Mariners jersey for this interview. And I'm sitting at my piano, so I've got, you know, the two worlds colliding right there. When I go to a baseball game, I mean, part of my enjoyment of baseball is the smell of hot dogs and the sound of the bat and the smell of the fresh grass and being outdoors and the roar of the crowd And oftentimes, like when I'm live in a ballpark, sometimes I'm actually unaware of what inning we're in, which I would never be if I'm taking in the game on radio or TV, because it's such
fascinating.
You know, the amount of sensory data coming to you is very focused. Same with a symphony. I think a lot of people enjoy going to a symphony because they get to wear a nice suit or gown. They get to go out. They see their friends. It's an event. All of those ways of experiencing things are all valid. You don't have to be keeping score at the ballpark, and you don't have to be sitting there analyzing every single thing that's played by the symphony. It's perfectly acceptable to explore those.
Yeah.
However, going back to my professor and our relationship, I knew that he had a very deep understanding and commitment to the language of music. And his brain was keenly attuned to translating those abstractions into meaning. And so knowing that, it gave us a language with which to reference similar aspects of baseball. So in other words, things that everyone sees and yet only few people see.
Yes, I myself have had no idea what inning is happening at a baseball game, but in kind of the opposite reason for you, I'm usually like, is there a more environmentally friendly way to keep this turf? Or, you know, I am just not paying attention. I like being outside. I can do that part of the baseball games, but the rest, you know, and my husband is having a completely different experience, especially once he finally kicks me out and then just gets to actually enjoy the game instead of answering all my inane questions. A piece of classical music that everyone knows, whether or not they know the name, is the 1812 Overture by Tchaikovsky, upwards of 15 minutes. But right around 4 minutes, we start hearing part that everybody knows. So let's listen to that now. And then later on in this composition, we hear the big finale. And that's pushing 15 minutes in. That first part is about 4 minutes in. And that section of notes, at least to my very untrained ear, I didn't hear that again. So let's talk about storytelling and suspense building when it comes to a composition like that.
That's a really good example of kind of like a first level detail that you might notice. Initially, you might have favorite parts, because that particular work, the overture, is in, it's sectional. It begins with a prayer. The opening few minutes are actually a prayer to save the Russian people. And then you have the introduction of, the Marseillaise. Not correctly. Marseillaise, there we go. Thank you.
The French national anthem.
So you see that, you hear other aspects that Tchaikovsky is going to interweave in a battle. And then at the end, of course, the Russian people emerge victorious. The first level of kind of understanding it beyond just a, wow, that's a climactic piece and there are cannons and God, I love that.
Right.
Most of the time, as you say, when people say they love the 1812 Overture, what they mean is they're puzzled for about 11 minutes and all of a sudden it reminds them, oh yeah, this is why I
that's
like the 1812
one.
Overture.
Yeah, get to the good part.
And so, like, you know, a famous home run, the Kirk Gibson home run or Kirby Puckett home run, that was preceded by 9 innings of baseball or more. And so people might be puzzled by the rest of the game, but they recognize those incredible moments. And I think for just about anything, it requires a hook. And so for you, maybe the hook into the 1812 Overture was really enjoying the cannon blasts and the bombastic nature, heroic nature of the end, which caused you to be more curious about it than on a subsequent listening. Who knows, maybe it's the 10th listening, 20th, 30th. you notice other details. It's like, wait a second, that theme already happened. And it's those kinds of things, those relationships internally, that really I'm most curious about in this exploration of baseball and Brahms.
Professor Dr. Eric Anderson, who teaches music at Minot State University, talking about the complexities and intricacies of baseball and classical music. And after this break, we live one of the greatest moments in Minnesota baseball history.
I hope that the listeners on Prairie Public tune into the Thomas Jefferson Hour, because I believe that we need to lift the idea of civilization and civility and culture, that we need, in a sense, to rise to the occasion of being what Jefferson had in mind for this civilization, and that the only way to do that is to be self-conscious about it and to work together to create the conditions under which we know we would be happier, more fulfilled, and more enlightened. And I think that the Jefferson Hour, in the broad world of public radio, is an important niche in which that project finds voice and creates a community of people who want to live in a more enlightened world than the one we happen to be born into.
Join Clay Jenkinson for the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Sundays at 11 a.m. Central, 10 a.m. Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are having our annual retail-free alternative to Black Friday, Day of Listening, and we are giving a deep listen to both baseball and symphony music, specifically the works of Brahms. We're visiting with Dr. Eric Anderson, a professor of music at Minot State. Let's talk about this now in terms of baseball, because so I'm thinking of Game 6 of the 91 World Series. Kirby Puckett hits a walk-off home run. He is forcing us into Game 7, which, you know, we then went on to win. We don't need to play clips from early on. We can just play the finale. Let's hear how John Gordon calls this game.
He's to the line, and the left-hander delivers. Puckett swings and hits a block. The Twins go to the seventh game. Touch them all, Kirby Puckett. Touch them all, Kirby Puckett. And the Twins have won this game 4-3.
So touch them all, Kirby Puckett. He's going to round the bases. It's a very exciting thing that just happened, and the Twins win this game. But there was a conversation going on throughout the rest of Game 6 between the pitcher and Kirby Puckett.
And really all season long, and perhaps even going into the previous season, there's some fascinating things about that relationship. Charlie Liebrandt was the pitcher. I mean, it's kind of funny how many people can remember who won a race but can't remember who finished second, or who did the big thing but can't remember who else was equally important in the play but is somewhat forgotten other than the GOAT. And Charlie Liebrandt is that in this case. He offered up, I think, a hanging breaking ball or changeup that it just didn't do what he wanted it to do, and Puckett knocked it over the fence. What's interesting, of course, is that baseball managers keep track now more than ever in 2020, certainly a lot more than 30 years ago, keep track of all the stats. How many times has this pitcher faced this hitter? What are their tendencies? What kind of a pitch does this pitcher like to throw to get people out? What kind of a pitch does this hitter tend to do really well with? Certainly the manager and the pitching staff were all armed with that information. And one of the things that the manager did, of course, was remove the previous pitcher and put in Liebrandt. And part of it was that the previous pitchers had pitched longer than they're used to. Atlanta had already burned through their two best relievers that evening, so they were on to their third reliever. But something about that matchup caused the Braves manager to suggest that statistically, Charlie Liebrandt was a good person to get Kirby Puckett out, or at least keep him in the yard. That didn't bear out. But if you look back at maybe previous at-bats, it could be that Puckett and Liebrandt had faced each other a handful of times over the previous years. Or it could be that Puckett liked certain styles of pitches that Liebrandt specialized in. And so the important thing is that it wasn't just a moment in time and just a single at bat, but all players involved and managers involved would have been considering relationships that had been potentially building for years.
Yeah.
One of the really curious things about this is, obviously, if you blow a Game 6 lead in the 11th inning by giving up a home run, that is going to leave an impression. And those impressions stick around as part of your relationship to the game and your relationship to situations. In an article that I was reading, it was talking about, this is Charlie Lebrand about 4 months later, and he was saying, of course, you know, he'd like to have that moment back, but he's going to go on and continue to do his career, which is what pro players have to do. They have to put failure behind them in favor of the longer battle. Lebrand had a great season in 1992, but interestingly enough, he became the losing pitcher in the next World Series in 1992, giving up 2 runs in the 11th inning of Game 6.
Okay.
And you just wonder,
so,
as he went out there to pitch the 11th inning of Game 6, how much was it in his mind that 1 year earlier he'd lost the game in the 11th inning of Game 6? That's sort of like a dream relationship in terms of trying to make the point that these aren't single moments in time. They are moments in time that are informed by and inform future moments.
In the hands of a novelist, this would be fodder for a narrative arc.
Yeah. It's fascinating. But let's say, like, the next night, Jack Morris in Game 7 pitched, I think, all 9 innings to win. Might even have been all 10 innings. I don't recall Game 7, but I know Jack Morris was the only pitcher to pitch for Minnesota that night, and then they won Game 7. The fascinating thing to study, and the way to me that this relates to a symphony, if you look at a symphony, has 4 movements that are each individual but tied together. Mm-hmm. Game 7 is its own game, but is absolutely tied in terms of the relationships and the ongoing battles to previous games. Probably Charlie Lebrand, under no circumstances, would be brought out in Game 7 because of what happened in Game 6, even though he'd thrown only a couple of pitches, and that was it. All of these pitchers, like Jack Morris is pitching, and by the time he gets up in the ninth, he's facing these same batters for probably the 5th time that game, and maybe even the 10th or 12th time in that series.
Hmm.
So it's not just a single moment. It is moments that have, there's a rich history between Morris and the other batters. And the more you get into those kinds of details of switches, of managerial moves, of little things that end up becoming important later on, that's when I think baseball becomes so compelling.
You know, I heard an interesting sports commentary earlier this year on NPR lamenting the shortened baseball season, and very specifically baseball. And it was for this same reason that baseball in particular has a story arc and a narrative that you're just not going to get across in fewer games that doesn't necessarily happen the same way in other sports. And I'm wondering, does that happen in the symphony? What happens if we only ever play the memorable part of a symphonic composition?
It's exactly the same thing, but it has to act as a hook. I don't think anyone learns to, let's take Brahms, for example. The symphonies, he wrote 4 of them, actually wrote many more, but burned them, but he published 4. They range in, let's say, they're probably that 30 to 40 minute category, whereas we all learn to watch a movie for 90 minutes, and we think 90 minutes is a very easy period of time to maintain concentration when it's a movie. Probably most of us associate music in that 2.5 to 4 minute range. And so a 45-minute work or a 40-minute work stretches far beyond anything that most people even know how to approach. I would say that the best way to become a more observant listener is to put it on as wallpaper, one. So if you wanted to get to know Brahms' Symphony No. 4, the second movement, you would just put it on and listen to it and listen to it and listen to it, much like we do pop music. You listen and listen, listen and listen. So you know when the vocalist comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You know when the guitar part. You don't have to count. You don't have to have someone cue you. You just know because you've heard it enough. So that sort of passive listening, it has inestimable value, passive listening. But if you're ever going to get beyond sort of that surface enjoyment of the favorite moments, it probably requires conversation with other people who have seen over hedges that you cannot see yet.
Well, take me over the hedges of this Brahms Symphony No. 4, specifically the second movement. Let's start with the French horn main theme. What are you hearing there?
Well, this is just like the introduction of a character, maybe the batter coming to the plate for the first time. Nothing has really happened yet, but you have to find out, you know, what is the theme that we're going to play with? And we've got... Okay, very simple, and it's stated several times. It kind of has this feeling like maybe it's dark, melancholy, maybe even angry.
Mm-hmm.
So those are things to note. One, the construction. We start in a main, here's the main note. We go up, back, and then down. Okay, so it goes up, comes back, goes down, comes back. Those are, if you can just keep that idea in your head, let's go on to the next clip. And in this one, the clarinets and violins are going to state the exact same thing, but now they're going to state it in major. So the
mood.
French horn initially had... Then the clarinet has, and we're in major, E major to be specific. Okay, so that's an example of an initial idea being brought in, and then immediately it starts to develop or transform. Same idea, but now it's slightly different. So then the next clip, this is going to show us as the clarinets take this idea, they change it slightly and then transition to a full-blown transformation where the violins come in with a brand new theme. Great. The main theme, then that's transition to major. Now the violins have... So now Brahms has changed the rhythm, he's changed the affect, it's clearly very lush, romantic, beautiful,
yes.
Yet if you look at the basic structure, it's exactly the same notes, it's exactly the same design.
I'm picturing a person walking, for some reason that's the visual that comes to me, but the lighting has been changing with every clip of the symphony.
Absolutely. that's the thing, is that if you don't know to look for it, you would never expect it. But when you know that this is the language of Brahms, the language of many composers, it's to take a single simple idea and to transform it as many ways and as powerfully as they can to create a large work out of a small amount of material.
In my visual, suddenly there's a lover that comes along with the violins.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're not wrong. Now it's going to be a more angry version of kind of the same idea, which is four notes up. So again, going up, coming back, going down, coming back. Okay, excellent. So the last clip I just want to share, we're going to start right where we left off. And this idea is going to fade out. We're going to get to just simply the French horn playing a single note that sort of references the very beginning. And then this idea is going to be taken over to the cellos in another beautiful, lush theme. So again, the exact same notes, but completely transformed. So let's listen to the last clip. So that's the same initial idea stated by the French horn. Mm-hmm. And I've just showed four transformations that Brahms uses. Basically, if you take a look at this entire 12-minute movement, there's almost nothing that isn't him turning that upside down or backwards or changing the rhythm or changing it from minor to major. And that's one of the things I'm getting at with Brahms and baseball. It's that on a baseball, the more little details you look at, the more rich the experience. And with Brahms, though I think there is nothing, no better way to interact with this music than to just listen to it and enjoy its surface beauty, the more details that you know, the more I think it makes you appreciate why hundreds of years later, this is still music that people study and reflect on and say, what a marvel.
Yeah. How many times do you listen to a piece of classical work before you feel like you really know it?
When I was 17 or 18, I don't know that I'd ever really listened to anything deeply. There were things I loved. The 1812 Overture was one of them. Bolero, I loved. My dad and mom had classical music on a lot. My music was really more Metallica and 1970s classic rock. But I had a kind of this working passive knowledge of classical. It wasn't until I got to college and started studying it and really blossoming in grad school with Professor Hanani that I started seeing Under Rocks. So I think I was in my early 20s. But the thing is, once you start discovering what's there, you can never unsee it. You start looking for those relationships and other things. It didn't diminish my appreciation of things that don't have that same sort of level of complexity, but it certainly made me look for that and enjoy it where it is to be found. And so I think Brahms and music constructed kind of in that same way has become a lot more rich and beautiful. It's something I seek out. To be honest, though, I really don't spend a lot of time just listening to music. Usually I'm cooking dinner, I'm driving in the car. I'm just, you know, we're too busy to
You're
sit
human.
Down and listen. Yes, but when I do get a chance to sit down and listen deeply, it's like, why don't I do this every day? My favorite stuff.
Let's go back to that game six of the World Series when Kirby Puckett hits that walk-off home run. I think this is an interesting comparison with what you said just a moment ago about how listening over and over and over can provide new information. And in a way, the announcer of a game can provide new information because Vin Scully called that very same play very differently.
Kirby Puckett with a single, a triple, a scoring fly ball, and a game-winning home run against Charlie Liebrand. The final score in 11 innings, Minnesota 4, Atlanta 3.
So all those other hits that Kirby Puckett had during the game just make this even more dramatic.
And he's providing lots of information. Of course, Scully, his job is specifically not to be partial to the Twins. He isn't. He's a national broadcaster.
Yeah.
And his job is to tell it like it is, whereas Gordon is losing his marbles. it's one of the most exciting days
right.
of his whole professional life.
Yeah.
The Twins announcer would certainly have a very different, would provide the listener with a very different experience of that. Probably not going to be cool, calculating, and reflective upon what else Puckett has done this game. Instead, it's just going to be overjoyed.
What is a conductor, a different conductor, going to bring to that listening experience?
That is a fascinating question because to some degree, people have recorded Beethoven's Fifth Symphony so many times or Brahms' Fourth Symphony so many times. Why is it Brahms didn't write a different symphony? It's not like they're not, it's not like they're recording a new version, right? It's all the same pitches, all the same instruments, all the same rhythms. And yet that is the magic of symphonic music. It's, and why I think it will never die as a live art form. When you think about plays, it's easy for us to understand that the same script has so many ways that it could be read by different actors. And in fact, there isn't a right way. There are different ways, and those different ways are interesting. You take a speech from Hamlet, and you get someone reading from the 50s, 60s, 80s, now, even you know, a more popular actor or a more Shakespearean actor, and they're all going to bring something different to the character. It's the same thing with a conductor. Maybe a little more subtle, it's exactly the same thing. The inflection and the way you breathe life back into the notes of a score, it's, that is precisely the art that musicians and conductors are supposed to do. It's not to repeat something that has been repeated. It's to breathe life back into black and white on a page that has everything and yet it has nothing. And the personalities of the players and the overall style or vision of the conductor comes together to make each live performance slightly unique. But you really probably can't appreciate those differences until you invest in the details of the symphony or until you know the work really well. And that's one of the things that I think is important here, is that symphonic music is not meant to be listened to once. It's meant to be listened to 100 times and to get richer each time. It's not popular entertainment. It's designed to be a masterwork. It's why people can go listen to these again and again and again for years, because it just gets better. Same with a sport like baseball. The more you invest in it, the more you open yourself up to when you watch it. And I would say the same thing for football. The classic thing is, well, why do they get on the line and they just crash into each other and fall into a pile and then they get up and do it again. And then at some point, someone says, we got a winner here.
Now, are you in my head?
And that's not untrue, but that's exactly exactly the kind of picture I'm portraying is there's a surface level understanding of things, and there's a deeper level understanding. And it all has to do with taking details that are in plain sight but yet unseen and making them part of your experience.
Well, for me, it's very much why I will watch the Olympics until my eyes bleed, but I can't spend 5 minutes watching a televised sport because I need that person who is giving me the history of where this person came from, and they're breaking it down, they're analyzing, they're freeze framing, you know. I get that. And we've talked about how the announcer could be like the conductor. And, of course, a coach would be like a conductor. I'm wondering if we can do this the other way around. Who in classical music would be Cal Ripken Jr.?
Wow. So Cal Ripken Jr., someone whose Hall of Fame stats are largely based on longevity and consistency rather than, let's say, Kirby Puckett, who had a shorter career, but really did amazing things in that short time. Certainly the rising star of all of conducting right now is Gustavo Dudamel. He's sort of the darling of the classical music world as far as conductors go. Came out of Venezuela in the El Sistema system. I just said system twice in two languages. Nice.
Next, we'll go to the La Brea
Tar Pits. Sistema program. Right? And I mispronounced French words earlier. Two strikes, third strike, and I'm out. You know, I'm not sure, certainly careers like Leonard Bernstein as a conductor are admirable. You know, Seiji Ozawa. Gosh, there's so many conductors. I mean, one of my favorite conductors is John Elliott Gardner because I believe he has longevity. The quality of his product I find to be incredibly consistent, maybe like a Cal Ripken.
Although, well, and I was thinking more generically, you know, who is the cellist, the shortstop of classical music?
Ooh. Cellist, agile, kind of a lot of things right now. Maybe Matt Heimovitz. Matt Heimovitz is a great example of someone that does a lot of stuff. And if he was born in a different era, he wouldn't have had the same career that he has now.
Sure.
But he sort of was a young person at a time when Yo-Yo Ma and others had started paving the way for doing Mark O'Connor, had started paving the way for branching out in styles. And so Matt was at the right place at the right time and had a real interest in playing in bars and playing different styles of music. He does all kinds of things. Yeah. Nigel Kennedy would be someone that precedes. So I guess if you look at some of the things that Yo-Yo Ma or Nigel Kennedy did, Nadia Salerno-Sonnenberg, to sort of push the envelope of what a traditional classically trained player would do in the late 80s and 90s, Heimovitz certainly inherited that and pushed that forward. And now you have so many people using the cello in so many different ways.
Yeah.
It's become kind of an all-purpose instrument.
What is the classical music equivalent of bunting?
These are great questions. Classical music, a bunt. Wow. The essence of a bunt is it's to use a particular skill set to deceive the other, to take advantage of a normal thing and get on base, or to advance a runner, to sacrifice oneself for the cause of the team. I mean, those are the functions of bunting. I guess maybe it's to be the inner voice. You know, if the cellos have the melody, and the second violins or first violins are playing the beautiful texture that makes the melody magical. They're doing something behind the scenes that doesn't draw attention, but makes everything better. Maybe that would be a parallel. Inner voices.
I'm curious because you are, of course, a professor and you are a performing musician and you have also worked as an assistant conductor. Did how you play music on stage change after you took on conducting duties?
I think slightly, though that short time with the Richmond, Indiana Symphony was wonderful. I have continued to sort of conduct both Allstate and Allcity and these kinds of events with large groups of kids. Also on campus, I'll do some stuff. I've remained active, though I don't really generally list those things on my like professional bio. Being a conductor, I don't know. I think the most difficult thing about being a conductor is managing personalities and giving leadership at the same time that you give freedom of expression and balancing that. And then just being a clock manager of time. So I think as a player from conducting experiences, I've become, I think, more aware of the value of rehearsal time and the minutes that tick by and making sure that when you're in a rehearsal, you take advantage of time to rehearse things, which means if something needs to be said, you have to say it. You can't wait till next week. You can't leave it unsaid, and you need to say it clearly and nicely. You need to stop rehearsal and get things done. Even as the principal cellist for the Minot Symphony, you know, if there's something I need to say, it is absolutely worth rehearsal time to just stop for a second and share that information. So I think as a player, I became more conscious of how valuable minutes are.
What do you think Professor Hanani would say about this conversation?
He would love it. He would absolutely love it. Here's the kind of spirit he has. So Diane and I love to cook, and we used to hold this all-day feast between us and our poor college friends called Roman Fest. And would basically, you know, all of us were living off shoestring budgets for groceries going to college, but we'd have this one party a year where we pooled our resources and we dressed up in togas and we basically ate and drank from 10 in the morning until 3 in the morning.
Oh boy.
And it was amazing. So I was telling Hanani about one of these on our trips to the airport. Mm. And on the day of Roman Fest, a FedEx package arrived with a really, really long feather in it. And I think it just said something, you know, about cheers, thinking of you, Yehuda Hanani. But it was the Roman tradition of the vomitorium and making yourself vomit so you could eat more. He would be delighted.
Professor Anderson, thank you so much for your time today. I have enjoyed this immensely.
You are welcome. I have enjoyed it too. And thank you so much for reaching out and allowing this opportunity to consider the question, Ashley.
It's Professor Dr. Eric Anderson from the Division of Performing Arts at Minot State University, where he is a professor of music. He is also the principal cellist in the Minot Symphony Orchestra and the artistic director of Dakota Chamber Music, a nationally recognized summer institute for strings and piano. Coming up next, poets respond to the global pandemic.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And as 2020 starts to come to a close, we find ourselves thinking, yet again, wow, this has been quite a year. Prairie Public has asked North Dakota poets to select one of their poems to share their feelings on our current point in history. It's produced by our director of radio, Bill Thomas.
Poems for the moment. We asked area poets to pick a poem for you, for now. Chad Peel.
One of the toughest things as a poet, at least for me, is writing topical poetry. That is, poems of the times, poems for events. But I do like to get assignments. And so I was pleased when Bill Thomas reached out to me asking if I had any poems that reflected our current times. And although I didn't, I said I would give it a try. I had been thinking of the idea of masks, both real and metaphorical. And so this is Masks. Believe me, it is much better to hide. I only wear it to protect you from what I may possess or what is inside. My true self, my virus, what may become. The need to conceal our identities should not be so easily dismissed. Without our masks, we would all be too free to spread what we carry or what exists truly within. Much better to suppress and not to share indiscriminately. Beware those who claim a barefacedness. I do not wear a mask, they say. Not me. What is truth, anyway? It is all fake news, a hype, a con. Believe me, it's great.
Bijou Anin, my name is Denise Lajmadir. The name of my poem is We Carry the Last Century. My father's mother died in the flu pandemic of 1918. I know little about her. As a child, she survived Indian wars, treaties, starvation, forced to live on a newly formed reservation. Now, 100 years later, I tell my grandchildren, my grandmother died in the flu epidemic. I wonder if I will survive this new pandemic. I think of Kukum, 23 years old with two children under four. Did she wear a mask? I wear one made of dragonfly print, the dragonfly a protector during wars, a symbol of rebirth, hope, renewal. Was she afraid as death closed in? Did she suffer, lungs filling, unable to breathe? Will my grandchildren say, my grandmother died during the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic? I wear my mask and breathe. Mingwich, thank you.
Denise Lajmadir. I asked her what she thought the role of poetry was during something like a pandemic.
Yeah, I like what Joy Harjo has said. I was watching her interview with Oprah, and she says every poem has ancestors behind it. And I thought, wow, this is exactly what I wrote about. I wrote about my grandmother. She's my ancestor. She says also that we are all stories, and I'm a narrative poet. I'm a storyteller. She says poems speak to the heart and soul and gut of it, and certainly that's what my poetry does, and that's what this poem does in speaking of the fears of what's going on right now. And then she says that poetry can lead us out of despair, and I certainly feel that. My poems are the poems about my life and fears and things that I've gone through, and it's my therapy. My poetry has literally led me out of despair. So that's why I love poems.
Hear more at prairiepublic.org or sign up for the podcast. Poems for the Moment is supported by Humanities ND and the listeners of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for November 27th. Emerson Hough was best known as a writer of the American West. Although he was born in Iowa, he became enchanted with the West when he moved to New Mexico. While there, he met and interviewed Pat Garrett. Garrett was famous as the man who shot Billy the Kid. Inspired by his connection to Garrett, Hough's first book was Story of the Outlaw, a study of Western desperados. In 1889, he began working for Forest and Stream magazine as the Western editor. He was hired by George Bird Grinnell, the founder of the Audubon Society. Hough became an ardent conservationist. On an 1893 trip to Yellowstone National Park, he expected to find 500 bison. his count barely reached 100. His articles about the declining bison population caught the attention of Eastern newspapers. They took up the cause against poaching, and in 1894, Congress passed a law that protected the wildlife in national parks. Huff wrote The Story of the Cowboy in 1897. It was the first of more than 20 books about life in the West. When two of his stories were made into silent films, he became the first Western author to find success in Hollywood. On this date, in 1908, the Devil's Lake newspaper published an article about the celebrated novelist. Huff made an extensive trip through Western Canada. He was enthusiastic about what he found in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. He wrote of wheat crowding up to the trail, high as the wagon seat. Huff became acquainted with Teddy Roosevelt and shared Roosevelt's fondness for North Dakota. He wrote that no one could describe the state better than Roosevelt. Nevertheless, Huff did the best he could. He wrote of the vast expanse of uninhabited land, the hills, the plains, and rivers. He had a soft spot for men called desperados, those who left civilization behind. Huff acknowledged that these desperados took the law into their own hands. He said the West attracted wild men from all parts of the country. Over the years, Huff maintained his connection to North Dakota. In 1908, he learned that the State Historical Society created a proposal for a memorial park at the state capitol. Huff wrote a letter of support, saying he applauded any effort to teach Americans about their history. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This Friday edition of Main Street. Thank you so much for your kindness, your gift of deep listening. We hope you enjoyed today's program and that you'll be back Monday for more listening. Until then, enjoy the rest of your holiday weekend.